Hello and welcome. This is an audio recording of an IFG live event. Hello and welcome to this IFG event, How to Avoid Government Mega Projects Becoming Mega Disasters, Lessons from the Past. I'm Bronwyn Maddox. I'm delighted to be here with a stellar panel to discuss how government can learn from the past to avoid these mega projects becoming disasters. We've got with us Dr. Nicholas Westcott, who's been director of the Royal African Society since 2017. He worked for the Foreign and Commonwealth Office and the European Union for many, many years, close to 40 years, I think, been involved with Africa for much of that time. And he's the author of Imperialism and Development, the East African Groundnut Scheme and its Legacy, which we're using as catalyst for this discussion. Nick, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Bronwyn. Pleasure to be here.
We've also got with us Baroness Amos, Valerie Amos, who's on our board. He's currently the Master of University College, Oxford University, having been the director of SOAS at University of London for 5 years and a member of the British government from 1998 to 2007, among many other things. Valerie, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks, Bronwyn.
And we have with us Professor John Kay, renowned economist, author of many books, including most recently Radical Uncertainty and Greed is Dead, produced during the lockdown. John, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure, Bronwyn.
And we have finally Giles Wilkes, who's a senior fellow at the Institute for Government and specialises in industrial policy, which he worked on as special advisor to Theresa May, and before that to Vince Cable, and generally acts as a provocateur on economic things for us. Giles, thanks for joining us as well.
Lovely to be here, Bronwyn.
Perhaps we can start with your book, which I must say I thoroughly enjoyed reading. It is witty, which not every book on government is, and I was struck by the sense of doom that fills your account of this project, which the Attlee government after the war embarked on, and it very quickly came to disaster. And perhaps you can just tell us something about it.
Thanks, Bronwyn. Yeah, and I think we might start just by asking what a mega project is. It's obviously a big project, tends to cost a lot. It's very often an infrastructural type project, but it can also be linked to transformational change. And it tends to be government run. There's nothing wrong with that. There are plenty of successful government run projects. And there are those who advocate the government should be doing more by way of projects in promoting innovation, establishing big infrastructure projects, or picking winners even. But if you just look at some of the recent mega projects with which the government has been involved, whether it's Track and Trace this year, HS2 over many years, Crossrail, and that wonderful OneWeb investment that the government has recently made, putting £500 million into orbit and waiting to see what happens, you can see that not all have been successful. And it's not just in the UK. The Berlin-Brandenburg airport opened finally this year, sort of 10 years late, three times over budget. And the wonderful, but sadly forgotten, Desertron, the American superconducting super collider, a rival for CERN, was cancelled some years back, having spent $1 billion and got nothing. So this is a long line, but if you like, the original, the scandal of this kind is the Groundnut Scheme. And it's one of the best stories never told, now much forgotten. There is, at the beginning of the book, a cartoon by Spike Milligan of a lad and his father gazing up as Concorde flies by. And the boy says, "What's that, Dad?" And he says, "That, son, is a flying groundnut scheme." At one time, this was known by everybody as an infamous scandal and waste of money. It began with the Attlee government, as you said, Bronwyn, and post-war era. The Attlee government has a reputation for reform, policy boldness, nationalising industries, launching the NHS, building thousands of homes, you know, classic building back better. But this didn't work in Africa. And the boldness that they showed at home sadly turned into dust in Africa. You need to remember that the scheme was launched in a period of post-war austerity, when everything seemed to be short. And in particular, dollars were short and food was short. And nothing, it seemed, was more strictly rationed than oils and fats, which, as we know, are essential for British baking, British cooking in all its forms. And of the shortages, that of margarine in particular hit home, and the government were desperate to try and increase the rations for what they called the harassed housewife of Hounslow, who desperately needed more margarine for her cooking. And in this context, Unilever, in the form of then the United Africa Company, a production outfit in Africa, came up with a scheme to transform 3 million acres, that's about 5,000 square miles, huge area, of empty, more empty-ish land in Central Africa, into a giant peanut farm. And they would do this, they reckoned, within 5 years, they could be producing 600,000 tons of groundnuts a year to export to the UK, which would then be useful for Unilever crushing plants for turning into oils, fats, margarine, and soap. And they sold this idea to the Minister of Food, John Strachey, who was delighted. It sounded the answer to all his dreams. And it was just the solution that he wanted. Now, Strachey was a very eloquent man, a skillful politician, the son of a famous editor of The Spectator, St. Lo Strachey. And his silver tongue persuaded the cabinet not only to back it, but for the Treasury to give it £24 million, which in those days was a lot, on condition that they got on with the job straight away, no delay, get cracking. This scheme was a disaster from the outset. They planned to build a farm in the middle of nowhere. There were no communications, nor much infrastructure. Nobody had any experience of clearing the African bush, turning into a farm. The bulldozers all broke down. And when they finally had planted some stuff, there was no rain. All this was not only predictable, but predicted. When the scheme was first put to experts, the Colonial Office, agricultural officials, local people on the spot, they said, "Oh, hang on a minute, I don't think this will necessarily work. The rain is a bit unreliable, the soil's poor, it's a long way from anywhere, the costs are very uncertain." But the government, nevertheless, had decided to go ahead. They decided also, to Unilever's relief, to do it as a government scheme, employing Unilever as a managing agent until they could set up a corporation. By the time the corporation took over in 1948, 1 year into the scheme already, things were going seriously off track. Costs were going through the roof. They were spending £1 million a month on the scheme. So that's £12 million a year. They would burn through the money in 2 years flat, rather than the 5 years. But Strachey was determined that the corporation was going to run things, and to make sure it ran the way he wanted, he put a friend of his in charge, Dick Plummer. Dick Plummer was the sidekick of Lord Beaverbrook. He was a newspaper man. He didn't know much about farming, knew even less about Africa, but he was a good friend. And with him in charge, things went from bad to worse. And the government at first tried to cover it up, and when they couldn't cover it up, to blame the communists. So altogether, with even in 1949, it's clearly going wrong, an election was looming, they hadn't got any groundnuts yet, but they decided to double rather than quit and carried on with the scheme, which ploughed on for a disaster till 1951, when Gateskill, as the new Chancellor of the Exchequer, finally pulled the plug on it. And the Treasury took the financial hit. They lost £36 million, which these days would be equivalent to about £1 billion. And Labour took the political hit. They lost the election in 1951. Just very quickly, we can draw some lessons from this. Firstly, obviously don't try to grow things where there's no rain. Secondly, don't rush. You need to test, you need to pilot, you need to learn from experience. And thirdly, if at first it don't succeed, ask why before you try again. Don't just plough on. Fourthly, it's worth listening to those who raise doubts, because some of them might be justified. And fifthly, be quite clear who is accountable. One of the big problems of the overseas food corporation set up by the government was that it was accountable to nobody except the minister. And it took great effort on the part of the parliamentary opposition to try and extract information from the government about it. And when they finally did, when people realised, it became the scandal that helped bring down the government.
Nick, thanks for that sweeping account of it. I just want to ask you a bit more about the government's motivation in this. You've got a bit where you say, in the end, for all the doubts and dodgy facts, the cabinet supported it because they wanted to believe in it. It seemed like an answer to their prayers. And you describe how the world's press and lots of representatives of other governments came thinking that this was the answer to world food shortages and all kinds of post-war austerity. I mean, there were plenty of warnings, weren't there?
There were, but there was a firm belief that African agriculture was primitive. The Africans themselves didn't have the skills necessary to develop the resources of the country. And therefore, bringing a bit of modern technology, fertilizer, would enable them, as one agriculturalist said, to make a soup purse of a sow's ear. And so they had 100% faith that they could deliver something that Africans working the same land for millennia had not been able to do.
And was it seen as a project to help Britain or to help develop an African colony as it then was?
The fundamental reason the Treasury was willing to put up £24 million for this was to provide food for Britain. It was, as I make quite clear, effectively exploitation of empty land in the colonies to feed Britain. That's part of what empire was for, to support the metropolis in its time of need. But they were able to dress it up as a colonial development project from which Africans would learn how to farm their own territory and everybody would benefit. So the Labour Fabian Colonial Bureau people were very much in favour of it as well, as an example.
Valerie, you were, among other things, Secretary of State for International Development. How did this strike you?
Thanks very much, Bronwyn, and thanks very much, Nick. A number of things struck me about this, in particular how some aspects of this have not changed so many years on. So I guess the first thing that struck me was this issue of context, that here we were in, you know, a period which was still a colonial period. There was an attitude of we know best as it were, as the colonial masters. This was all about putting the colonies to work. So there was a mindset, a wider contextual mindset that I think was problematic. And I think despite the changes we've seen, there is a way historically that governments have thought about development and elements of that mindset which still prevail today. And we've gone through many different iterations of this in the development context, in particular how you align national priorities with your development priorities. And there's been a fight over many, many years to try to make sure that the two aren't so closely brought together, because what that means sometimes is that the developing country misses out. And there's been a lot of concern that the bringing together of the FCO and DFID is a slippery slope in that respect. I think that Nick's book is really important in setting out how not to do things. But I would also want to say that it is important to sometimes have these big projects. It's about ambition. It's about a forward look. It's about thinking the unthinkable. It's about a risk, a particular kind of risk appetite. But if you want to be transformational, sometimes you have to take those risks and you have to be forward looking. But there are things that you have to be aware of. So the political hubris that kind of imbues this whole project, not listening to the experts, I mean, that absolutely runs through, and we still see that today. I am really struck by the fact that, you know, the government of Tanzania is missing in action. No role in the decision-making here. How did this project in any way relate to the priorities of the country, the capacity, the capability? This is one of the reasons that the whole thing foundered. And of course, as a developing country government, very often you're looking for external validation. You're wanting to demonstrate to your people that you're doing something. You have the capacity with help to do something significant. So very often governments will accept programs and projects in their countries that actually aren't right for the country. And that's a huge problem. And then what do we actually learn looking back and looking forward? And I've seen many, many of these reports, which are about lessons learned, which are just gathering dust on the shelf. But Nick pointed to some of these that are important. You need clarity of purpose. You need to interrogate. Why are you doing it? How are you doing it? How much is it going to cost? What are the skills and the capacities that you have? And I think in some of this project management, governments can learn from the private sector, although I'm not of that mindset which always says that the private sector is right. You need to know your market. And as Nick said, these issues around accountability and responsibility, and actually who at the end of the day you're going to look to if it doesn't work, that needs to be absolutely clear.
Great. Well, thanks very much indeed for that. I think many people would agree with you. John, can I pass it to you? You've written extensively about things that go wrong in government, among many other things. And you have a lot of views on, indeed, mega projects and why they go wrong.
In my own work, I've talked a bit about mega projects, as you say. And I have known relevant knowledge of development in Africa. But I've took two example mega projects in what I wrote quite a few years ago now, which were what I called Khrushchev's Maze and the Advanced Gas-Cooled Reactor Program in the UK. And the story of Maze is of Khrushchev getting the idea that improvement to Soviet agriculture would be accomplished by a large-scale transformation of wheat growing to maize, having believed that much of the success of the US economy was attributable to the fact that maize was a principal crop there. So a large part of Soviet agriculture was converted to maize. Maize was a much less suitable crop for Ukrainian and Russian conditions, in fact, than it was for American conditions. But in a phrase that really sticks with me, Khrushchev was told that the initial failures were the result of sabotage. Under socialism, maize can be grown anywhere. The story of advanced gas-cooled reactors was of a British design, a pioneering design, put forward in the mid-1960s or developed in the late 50s, put forward in the 60s. And the British government ordered five, ultimately seven, reactors of this kind, which were built in the 20 years that followed, because the average length of time it took to build one was 20 years. None of them ever operated at rated capacity. In current prices, it cost probably £150 billion. I've described it as the worst commercial project in history, and it was certainly on that scale. Now, what happened with both of these? Firstly, the projects were idiosyncratic and transformational. Now, as Valerie has said, there's nothing wrong with that. You have to have transformational projects sometime. But they were also done on immense scale, and in both cases, quite unnecessary scale. You could have had an experiment, small-scale experiment in the Soviet Union with maize, which would not have worked, and stopped it there. You could have built one of these reactors to smaller skies in the UK, and when you discovered it was much harder than you thought, stopped it there. But so there was scale which was actually unnecessary. But importantly, there was also no honest feedback Nick has described the process in Groundnuts. I've just described the process in Khrushchev. The process in the advanced gas cooled reactor saga was, if anything, even worse than that. There was constant lying, cover-up, concealment. And actually, incredibly, it was only when there was an unsuccessful attempt to privatize the nuclear power stations as part of the privatization of electricity in the 1980s that the truth finally started to emerge. Because the very depressing story is that people in the CEGB and Atomic Energy Authority seemed to think it was all right to lie to Parliament, but could not take the risk of lying in a stock exchange prospectus. And the planned flotation of the nuclear plants failed in the late 80s and had to be done on a very different basis in the following decade. In the end, as many of you will know, the plants were sold to EDF of France, who are, of course, not much better at it. If we look at the three real mega projects we have in the UK today, which are HS2, the ongoing saga of London airports. HS2, Crossrail, London airports are the same story. Excessive scale in planning, lack of honest feedback. And what I did when I wrote about these was to contrast these failed mega projects with what is the great transformational project of our time, which is what has happened in information technology. And of course, the story of that is everything going wrong for the established companies and the business. That is, IBM was effectively destroyed by the personal computer revolution. And I just pulled out for myself in advance of this the famous 2007 video of Steve Ballmer, then chief executive of Microsoft, picking up an iPhone, laughing hysterically and saying, who is going to pay $500 for a phone? That's why consulting experts is something one does need to do. But the way transformational change occurs is typically in the face of experts, like Steve Ballmer, like the people at IBM who didn't see the personal computer revolution coming. And when they did, actually played a real important part in it. But in what has been an absolutely typical story, they failed to make anything effective commercially out of it in the long run. It's a constant experiment which happens in market economies with honest feedback, which enables these kind of transformational changes to be made. And that's why the computer revolution happened in the United States and didn't happen in the Soviet Union. Although paradoxically, we've learnt in the last decade or two that Soviet education taught people how to code and the relevant underlying mathematical skills rather better than the West actually achieved in doing these things. So what we need is systems that are, often we will have to have things that are idiosyncratic, but wherever possible, we should try and do them on a small scale, get honest feedback, and have options to respond, react, and modify. And the HS2 story provides an excellent example of that. We have what is probably the largest mega project of our time in HS2. It's running in the predictable way, massively over time and over budget. And there are alternatives. A group of rail engineers have prepared a scheme they call HSUK, and what it does is it makes piecemeal improvements to the existing network, which actually provide faster connectivity between cities at much less cost than the grandiose HS2 project is actually capable of doing. And more than that, it gives one options. we don't, any of us, know how transport is going to evolve in the next 20 or 30 years, which is the minimum relevant time horizon for all of this. Autonomous vehicles are going to change the nature of both public and private transport in ways we have yet to imagine. That's the radically uncertain world in which we live. And we need to give ourselves flexibility, options, operate on a small scale, have honest feedback. And all the mega projects we're describing failed to do these things. And as we're seeing, they go on failing to do these things.
John, thanks very much indeed. Thanks, and thanks for picking up some of the themes you've dwelt on in your books. So, Giles, listening to all this, and you've been advising governments, politicians on industrial strategy and how to make these kind of decisions. What do you make of this chronicle of disasters and things that are too big that we've been talking about?
Well, the first point I'd like to make is it's extremely welcome, because one of the classic problems you get with special advisors and other projectors on the inside trying to promise great things is they don't look at the failures, they look at the successes. Here's my favorite industrial strategy cliche, which is some new tech advisor in government or some advisor who's read about tech. He will say, hey, why can't we have Silicon Valley here? This has happened constantly for the last 20, 30 years. And what they do is they then send delegations over to Silicon Valley and sit at the feet of the great tech entrepreneurs and the venture capitalists. And they look at what happened there. Was it the design of the Hewlett-Packard garage or something to do with the military over there or something? There's a Wikipedia page of hundreds of Silicon Valley wannabes as a result. And what they should be doing is going on a tour of all the failures or the partial successes and asking themselves what went wrong there. And this is, to be fair, what you'll get in a business school. We'll have case studies, and the case studies are fascinating. They're not all case studies of how Bill Gates created Microsoft. There'll be case studies of New Coke as well. So number one, the most welcome thing you can have is the diligent study of failures, even if it makes you unpopular when you're discussing things. I mean, number two, I don't wish to appear sycophantic, but the truth about markets, John's book about how markets do their magic, which I must have read something like 15, 16 years ago, and great examples in there, including the Magnox nuclear disasters and Khrushchev turning up at the supermarket wondering how all the stuff got there. It's an incredibly influential book for me, because another classic mistake that politicians and industrial strategists make is to favor the visible over the invisible. So the thing that they felt they had some agency about, could see the causal result of, and was a great success, they'll go on about that endlessly. But all the great things that are going on in the economy that didn't need a government conscious plan, they tend not to reflect on as much. So in the industrial strategy report I'm writing for the Institute right now, I just mentioned very casually things like the growth of cloud computing. Now, it's gone from nothing to a $200 billion global market in a matter of 15 years. Now, of course, the government plays some role. It educates the entrepreneurs and the technologists who did it. But ultimately, nobody sat down and directed it that way. It came about because the market signals, the constant experimentation that John referred to there, were constantly nudging us in those sorts of directions. And yet, you'll have
and
far
you know,
more...
Charles, if- I could interrupt for a moment.
Of course.
It's to say that what made cloud computing, the great success in cloud computing, is not Microsoft, it's not IBM, it's not Apple, it's Amazon.
Yeah. Yeah. And they found it almost serendipitously that they were serving their own online delivery.
But the repeated story in this technology area has been that it's been new companies who have defied what was the existing wisdom, who have actually created these, deployed these new innovations successfully.
Yeah, and so Giles, just to finish your thought, and then I'm going to come back to Nick and Val, just to finish your thought about what government should do. It's got all these case studies out, it's got marvelously eloquent ones like Nick's book, it's got all these ones we're looking at the moment, like HS2. What should ministers do?
Well, I mean, one thing is they should make sure that the automatic systems we have that provide challenge or force governments to have to study their business cases do not get binned. So the Institute for Government has taken a very strong line, for example, that we need state aid rules. Now, state aid rules are a phenomenal pain, but they're also a way of forcing yourself to check that you're not doing something stupid, that you're not benefiting a visible competitor against the invisible market. and so forth. We need to keep those sorts of things. And the fact that they're inconvenient should be regarded as a feature, not a bug. This idea of red teaming, you have somebody in there whose job it is to challenge, it's quite a fashionable idea, apparently quite an old one as well. This is what Whitehall at its best is really good at, people questioning one another's ideas. We need to keep that sort of process going too. But fundamentally, we need to remember that if we want to embark on industrial strategy, the people who are sceptical about it and actually are big fans of the market, they need to be kept in the room. You just need to keep those people in the room saying, are you sure this is a good idea? Hasn't it been tried before? If it's such a great idea, why wasn't it tried before? Skepticism is a good thing in making policy.
So, Nick, can I come back to you in the book? And incidentally, I've got a good question among many good ones that have come in. This one from Munira Dasaji, who's a principal operational research analyst at the Ministry of Justice, and she'd like to know more about what criteria officials and ministers actually used in the ill-fated groundnut scheme. But I wonder if you could just tell us a bit from your long experience in government where officials come into this. And what their relationship was, and again, what went wrong on the decisions in this particular scheme.
Yes, one of the reasons I was moved to write this book was because I kept on seeing echoes of it in decisions that I was involved with or visible to me from inside government. And as Giles says, you actually learn a lot more from looking at failures than necessarily at successes. The idea was clearly gripping, and it was subjected to critical examination within Whitehall. Some real problems were identified. Again, it was an area that not many people knew much about. So the ministers tend to feel, well, we overcame these kind of risks. We took these risks in the war. We overcame these kind of problems. We just sort of will find a way to do it. And the feeling was these naysayers are mere doubters. We just go and try it and see and learn on the job. And that prevailed. Nobody except the finance people who said we are not willing to, as authorizing officers, go to Parliament and say this money is going to be well spent. And sought what was called a ministerial direction to require them to do it. This doesn't happen very often. It happened in the Pergau Dam, for example, another scandal. So there were people trying to say, whoa, hang on, and they were overridden. And the reason they were overridden is ultimately this was the scheme that the government wanted to work because it would solve all their problems. And therefore, they suspended disbelief. They, if you like, established criteria that meant even if it went over budget, it was still going to save dollars because otherwise we'd have to buy the ground nuts from dollar sources. And therefore, the costs didn't matter. What mattered was it was being done inside the empire for sterling. And because rations were so short, any quantity was a benefit, whatever the cost. And actually, that was not the case. And as Valerie says, the local government was just not involved at all. It was a sort of alien spaceship that came down and landed in the middle of Tanganyika, and the local government just sort of watched it with bemusement, rather like the local tribesmen who said, I wonder why they're trying to do that here. It'll never work. But nobody asked them. And so this political impetus sort of drove all before it. And that meant any substantive criticism was simply brushed aside.
What do you all feel that current mega problems are engaged in? And we're recording this on the day when news of one vaccine apparently being successful in trials has just come through. How do you weigh this up against government's efforts, government's plural, efforts to combat the coronavirus and throwing really feels like unlimited amounts of money at it at the moment?
There are areas where you have to do that because you don't have any option. Nobody knows what the answer for a vaccine is. You just trial and error is required. You could say the same of track and trace. But again, there appears to have been a huge amount of money slung at this without any, without much success. And again, you don't proceed in a logical way of looking at what has worked elsewhere and trying to apply that. It's this this mystique of we will invent something that is world-beating all by ourselves, and therefore it must be made to work. Failure is not an option. Well, actually, often it is the only option if you just take the wrong tack to start with.
Here on this issue of the vaccine, because I think that it has shown some really important things. One is the importance of collaboration, because normally you have real competition when you've got the private sector trying to develop a vaccine. Here you have collaboration between the different universities and the different private sector organisations that are trying to do this, and that's because we have a global crisis. You've got a strong partnership between academia and the private sector here. And also speed has been really important. So really looking at where you could short circuit certain elements of this has worked very, very well. So I do think that there are some critical pointers here that the vaccine initiatives have shown us.
Can I take a rather different view on these issues in coronavirus? Because it seems to me we've seen a variety of the things we've talked about going right and going wrong in all of this. The track and trace, and most of all, the attempt to design a British app, was a script we've seen played out so many times before. We're going to do something idiosyncratic on scale, and it is going to be better than anything anyone like Apple or Google could have. We know how that ends up, and we know how it did end up this time. And what we've had repeatedly in the coronavirus incident, starting with the Public Health England testing system at the beginning, has been the same. We need something that is outstanding, distinctively British, and centralised. And our record on testing has, as we all know, been very poor. I'm not sure that the story of the vaccine is as simple as one of the effectiveness of collaboration. If we get a vaccine, it will be because we've had a dozen groups trying to develop a vaccine, of which two or three might work. But also, the search for a vaccine is a rather unusual mega project, in that it's one of the kind where we don't really care what it costs. The prize is so large that the cost doesn't really matter. And we've had successful historic mega projects like the Manhattan Project or the moon landings that you could do in that kind of way, because in the end, the cost didn't really matter. The only thing that mattered was getting the final result. And that's true of the vaccine.
Right, John, so, but I mean, I want to ask you about this one, because it seems to me there's a real question about how you distinguish at the time between what is worth it, you know, money without end, almost. And there was no sense in which the Moon Project was necessary. It was just a deeply desired. And one of the things I found very powerful about Nick's book was the political context at the time of, you know, immediately after the war, where rationing did not lift immediately, and the government was having to go back to people every 3 months or so and say, actually, this ration is being extended, and we might even have to ration bread. And the sense of political pressure on politicians is very resonant to me of the coronavirus pressure now, of people really, really fighting again. You know, end of the war had come, but liberation from lack of food had not, and this was where this had come from. And even though it seems so fanciful to us now, it didn't feel like it then. It felt, as he wrote, like the answer to their prayers. And that you know, in the pressure of the moment, isn't it that governments reach for these solutions, and we might stand back afterwards. What I'm fishing for is a way, you know, for governments to distinguish between the things that they're going to look plenty stupid decades afterwards, and the ones that really are essential.
Well, the coronavirus has the timescale aspect on it as well, as in the food after the war. But what should have been done in terms of groundnuts was not necessarily abandoning experimental ways of getting food. What should have been done was many different experiments should have been made, most of which would have failed. Most experiments, most innovations do fail. And it's that fact that makes it very difficult for government to do these things well ever.
I think, John, I was just going to say, you've put your finger on it there, and I just wanted to underline this, because the reason we will end up with a successful vaccine is because you have half a dozen pharmaceutical companies and research outfits competing to find a vaccine. Some of them will work, some of them won't. But they're doing it according to their sort of commercial and scientific criteria. And the striking thing about the groundnut scheme was the private sector knew this was too risky. They were not going to risk their own money on it. Somebody in the Treasury asked, you know, if this is such a brilliant scheme, why doesn't Unilever do it itself? They would never have risked their own company's money on this. The pharmaceutical companies are willing to, because they know there's going to be a big reward at the end. And had the government said, you find the best place to grow us groundnuts, we'll buy them, that would have happened.
Indeed.
All right. Can I let me bring in a question? We've got a batch of good ones, and we've just got a few minutes to go. And it's from someone who doesn't want to give her name, but she's in the House of Commons and involved in scrutiny there relevantly. And she says, can the panel recall any examples of parliamentary scrutiny, whether committees, bill debates, or through questions, actually helping to avert a mega disaster? And she wants to know whether Parliament has the tools and skills to do this, as opposed to only holding governments to account after something has gone wrong. Rack your memory.
Valerie, you must have one.
Such examples. Heading off a disaster.
I'm not sure I do. I mean, I'd have to give it a lot more thought. I mean, plenty of examples where there's been significant parliamentary scrutiny during something and after. I'm really trying to think very hard about anything that I was involved in before it happened.
It's actually a good question, because if it averted a mega disaster, then the disaster didn't happen. Therefore, it's not really going to survive. We'll just think of it as good parliamentary procedure. But it's an interesting challenge about how much Parliament does get to grips with these kind of things when they're in process. So, I mean, John, if we take the big projects going on at the moment, or Giles, and you think of Parliament's scrutiny, and they're not done deals in the sense of the airport in the southeast, it seems to be perpetually.
It's the least done deal there's ever been. Yeah.
I can say, Bronwyn, I can say from personal experience that fear of the Public Accounts Committee is tangible inside government, particularly among civil servants. And I dealt for 5 years with IT projects. And we were terrified that we would initiate an expensive IT project which would go wrong and we'd all be hauled up. So we took great care to make sure that the IT projects, and the fact you've never heard of these Foreign Office IT projects, is because we took huge care to make sure that we didn't end up before the parliamentary committee.
Yeah, and I could add to the list. I mean, they're just poring over it, over universal credit that parliamentary committees have done with, and throwing all kinds of brickbats absolutely deservedly at the system is one reason why, when it came to the coronavirus, the system did actually work in managing to get benefits out to people. So that's possibly there. I think we're not obliged in this session to spend time on the sunshine side of the ledger. But John.
Right. I think, Bronwyn, you've identified what I've called the Captain McWhirr problem, which comes from Conrad's novel Typhoon, where you remember Captain McWhirr sails into the storm. And when the mate says, are you sure about this, McWhirr? McWhirr responds, if I sailed round it and arrived in port two days late, the agent would say to me, why are you 2 days late? And I would say, to avoid the storm. And he'd say, must have been a really bad storm, to which I'd have to say, I don't know.
Yes.
I sailed round it. And that's the problem that any regulator or a government agency routinely has. You're never thanked for the crisis that didn't happen.
Yes. Sorry, did I interrupt you, Nick or Giles?
No, I was gonna make much the same. I mean, we've got the same problem right now in real time happening with coronavirus and lockdowns and warnings about them. The counterfactual we never know about, really, is what the infections and death rates would have been had they not done it. But we do know now that if the infections fall very fast, Boris Johnson won't be told he did a great job in doing a lockdown. People will be saying you have no need to. The storm wasn't as wild as you warned it would be. As for stopping terrible projects, I mean, it's difficult to know what counts. Like, we've all stopped Boris Johnson trying to build a bridge across to, is it Northern Ireland? By just talking about it and making it obvious it's a dark idea. Likewise, the Boris Island. I bristle slightly at the complaints about Heathrow's third runway being a mega disaster. It's been politically badly handled, but it's not a story like Berlin yet. But boy, would that island in the estuary have been something.
Yeah. Nick, do you want to take us into a bit what role officials play in this and what responsibility you feel that they should have?
There's a very good analogy with the Pyrgau Dam, where it itself was not a disastrous mega project, but where officials are required to do things against their better judgment. And there is a big risk that where a political project is embarked upon, it becomes almost impossible to give advice that might call into question this project. And I would say mega projects includes political mega projects as well as physical infrastructure ones. And that is the challenge when there is an effective self-government, self-censorship within government, because you know your advice is not going to be welcome. And one of the great strengths of the British Civil Service traditionally has been that because you are covered by official secrecy, you give 100% honest advice about what the impact of a decision will be. And if ministers then choose not to take account of that, that is their political responsibility. But we have seen that eroded recently. And that really concerns me in that, firstly, civil servants are taking the rap for mistakes that ministers have made. And secondly, civil servants who choose to give their honest advice, but it is not welcome to ministers, are then moved out of the way. And that will be a real handicap to any government, to be honest, going forward. It is much better you have those debates inside government than outside. In the Groundnut scheme, it was all eventually came to be revealed in Parliament that there had been people with some doubts about this, but the failure spoke for itself.
You also bring in another question from Chris Peters, who said, and he's referring to Crossrail and HS2, and he's asking whether private contractors knowingly underbid. This is a very worldly question. And so if is government over a barrel when the project gets underway? Giles? John? Val?
This is something I have heard, that if you remember the Carillion failure, and I bet John wrote some really interesting stuff about that, so I'd love to hear it. But I had the job in Downing Street of asking the contractors that were now all toppling, why on earth are you bidding at levels where you lose money? And it's known as winner's curse by economists. The people who pay the most for a contract end up necessarily overbidding. But they seem to think that there was some phenomenal game of sort of you've got to pay to play. But I suspect they also had in the back of their mind, well, I'm doing something really important. Somehow or other, the government will come in and help me, which seemed, in retrospect, remarkable. And I'm glad, in a way, the one people who weren't helped in that story were the shareholders who joined in on that bet.
Yep. I mean, the winner's curse is one problem, and the classic example of that is the 3G license auctions, where the licenses necessarily went to people who overpaid for them. But I think the phenomenon of people underbidding to get the project, we all know from our own experience of hiring builders that the builder expects to make the money on the variations. And that's true of all these kinds of projects. And part of what goes on here is that the people who are advocating a project, whether they're private sector agents bidding for it or the people advocating the project, either in government or outside it, have every reason to underestimate the final costs in order to gain political momentum behind the project, and they can then rapidly increase the budget as the project progresses. I've thought of it as the hook, because one sees it again and again. The project is budgeted initially at some very low amount. You then, having gained political momentum behind the project, come in at some much higher figure. And quite often, you actually congratulate yourself for having come in below the absurd figure. I mean, in a sense, the point Giles jibbed at a bit at the Heathrow Airport issue. But part of the point here is that someone ought to have said, among other things, when you come back with the idea that it costs £25 billion to create a new runway at Heathrow Airport, go away and come back with some sensible number. And that doesn't happen. So an example I liked was the new Forth crossing in Scotland. Initially, that was budgeted at a few hundred million. Once there was political commitment to build it, the amount was raised to 4 billion, and it then came in at a very respectable-looking 1.5 billion. With the same story as of the Olympic Games. Initially, the budget for that was 1.5 billion. When we were on the point of getting it in the proposals for the bid, it rose to about 2.5 billion. It then rose to 12 after London had been selected to host the Olympics. We still don't know what it really cost, but there is this extraordinary lie now at the moment that the Olympics came in within budget. It's only true in the most absurd of senses. There is the hook. You come in, you begin with low numbers, which gain political enthusiasm for the project, and you then discover that the realistic cost of doing it is not just larger, but possibly orders of magnitude larger.
John, can I come back and ask you something in relation to that? And it links to a point you raised at the beginning, because you talked a lot about the need for honest feedback. Can you say a bit about where that feedback would come from, but also in terms of getting value, do you have to have a competitive open market to get that value?
I think the competitive market is less to get value than to give people the freedom to engage in small-scale experiment. In a sense, there are some projects that obviously, if they're done at all, have to be done on scale. You can't, if you're building a channel crossing, you can't do a small-scale experiment. On the other hand, in the London Airport case, you can get piecemeal expansion at Gatwick, for example, while you are learning about what needs to be done in Heathrow, although, you, to be honest, you've had quite a lot of time to learn about what needs to be done at Heathrow. But there are almost always smaller-scale alternatives which will generate this process of feedback. We don't need to be building nuclear power stations on the scale on which the Hinkley Point, the Flamanville, and the Finnish one I can't pronounce are. Rather bizarrely, the only nuclear power stations that are currently being built in Europe are an Eastern European design in Eastern Europe, which are on quite a small scale to a Russian design, of which there are a lot around the Eastern world that are actually working and have been working effectively and safely for 20 years. I know that selling a Russian design of a nuclear power station would be a pretty hard sell in the UK or the United States. But it's smaller scale things that in which you've had trial and error and feedback and you know they work. And where it's possible to break down a project in that kind of way, we should do so. But politicians often don't like that.
No, they often don't. We're coming up to the end of this, and I want to come back to Nick and Val at the end. I mean, this is not a session or a discussion about development aid. And indeed, as Nick said in his book eloquently, that this project was, the Groundnut Scheme was conceived of as a source of food for Britain, not as a way of developing the infrastructure of Tanganyika as it was then. But I wonder, in particular, Nick and Val, with your long experience in in overseas development and looking at that, whether there are lessons for that kind of work from what we've been talking about particularly about big things not working and not working to plan. So it becomes a Vowel first and then Nick.
Thanks, Bronwyn. I think there are huge lessons here. Principally, who's it for? And what's intended? And one of the things that I think we've learned over the years with respect to development projects is that there's got to be clarity about what is best for the country in which you're working and what is best for the people of the country in which you're working. And I remember when we had the major debt relief initiative and had to work very, very hard to get that through and agreed by the G7 governments. One of the challenges around that was if you release the country from the debt, what did they then spend their money on? And there was a huge debate in Ghana as to whether or not they should apply for debt relief because of the reputational damage for the country and so on. But what the government then did when they did get the debt relief was when they were able to build a school, for example, they put up a very big sign to say to the people, this is what you got because we didn't have to service this major debt. So in terms of the lessons for development aid, I think there are major lessons there in this book. And there have been major lessons along the way as we have looked at the impact of the work that we have done. And I think that we have to learn some of those lessons rather than just moving on to the next thing.
Thank you. And Nick, to come back to you, your book is called Imperialism and Development, the East African Groundnut Scheme and Its Legacy. What was the legacy for Tanzania as it is now?
The legacy was that a huge amount of money was wasted that could have been used much more effectively to promote development had it been geared towards supporting small peasant farmers rather than mechanized bulldozers that broke down in the bush. And I would draw two lessons from this. One of the reasons it failed was the scheme was accountable to the British Parliament, not the local people and the local producers. One of the striking things is that since independence, there has still been a plethora of groundnut schemes all over independent Africa, because none of the lessons passed across the barrier of independence. And everything started again from scratch, and governments thought, right, we must develop our countries, and launched off making exactly the same mistakes, in particular, not going to the local people and saying, what do you need to develop, but prescribing a formula for them. And secondly, because there was no effective accountability for a lot of these projects within the governments. They were prestige projects launched by politicians or presidents and very rarely held to account. So proper accountability and proper consultation. And as John says, start a number of small, sometimes competitive schemes and see which ones work. Interestingly, this is happening in the private sector in IT in Kenya and Nigeria, whereas the Nigerian government embarked upon a massive steel mill, the Abeokuta steel mill, which has been losing money for 30 years. So I think the lessons are very clear. And they come out at the end of the book because the areas that have been cleared for the groundnut scheme were eventually turned over to peasant farmers who did very well, growing completely different crops, but ones which they chose.
Thank you. Well, we're going to have to draw it to a close there. And we've managed this whole discussion without the word China, although you do mention that in your book, Nick, and indeed that China is now building the railway where our country needed it, and as the scheme did not. We're going to have to stop there. I'm sorry for all the questions I couldn't get in, which are very good ones, but thank you for sending them. And thank you very, very much to Nick Westcott, Valerie Amos, Giles Wilkes, and John Kay for being part of this. And if you want to hear more of our work, it is, of course, at our website, instituteforgovernment.org.uk, and our weekly podcast is called Inside Briefing. We'd love you to listen to that. Many thanks, and see you all soon. Thank you for listening, and we hope you've enjoyed this edition of IFG Live. Please do subscribe to hear more. And if you'd like to know about our upcoming events, please visit instituteforgovernment.org.uk/events.